This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Whether brought on by a good joke in the moment or a remembered one at a completely inappropriate time, laughter is part of being human. But why do we laugh? Is there a physiological reason behind the giggles? An evolutionary one? Here to explain why our funny bone gets tickled is cognitive neuroscientist Scott Weems, the author of Ha! The Science of When We Laugh and Why. Scott, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Let's start with a joke from the late comedian Mitch Hedberg. I'd like you to listen and then explain why our brain processes this as funny.
Hey, I bought myself a parrot. The parrot talked, but it did not say I'm hungry, so it died.
All right, Scott, what do you think? Can you work with that?
Yeah, wow. So, I mean, that joke, it's obviously kind of dark and edgy. I think that joke probably is funny to some of us because it comes close to that sweet spot that we like our jokes to have a little bit of edge, but too much and they threaten us. So I think fortunately we all know that our animals are not going to starve because they don't know how to ask to be fed. So it's not that threatening, but it's just enough to put us on edge, I guess.
Well, how does humor actually happen in the brain? I mean, you make a, I think one of your chapters begins with somebody saying that it's easier to read a book about humor than to describe it. What is going on? What's happening that makes us find something funny?
Yeah, I mean, it's complicated. I think if it was something simple or if there was a rule or a formula, I think we would have discovered it a long time ago. When really, I think it's a psychological process, humor is. And it comes down to in our brain, without getting too technical, there's one region of the brain called the anterior cingulate that detects conflict. This is a brain region that's very active when something surprises us or puts us on edge, kind of just basically makes us have to reconcile what's going on. And so that makes humor a bit of a process of discovery. I mean, we enjoy being thrown off a little bit, and we really enjoy putting things back together again, which is what most jokes do. And I'm not sure exactly how I would compare that with the parrot dying joke, but I mean, I think we all realize that parrots probably aren't going to die of starvation, so that's kind of why it's a little bit funny.
Well, okay, so our mind is kind of reckoning something and being resolved. So explain to us a little bit about some of the research you found on the evolutionary role that humor and laughter played for human beings and why it actually meant something for their survival.
Sure, yeah, I think humor is very important, evolutionary speaking, and for our survival. I mean, it's probably on the same level as intelligence and creativity. And it really comes down to, this is a very advanced thing that we do when we get a joke. Even linking to the parrot joke we were talking about before. This takes some work to figure out what is originally intended and then what is actually the truth of the joke. And so, I mean, there's some benefits to be able to do that and relatively fast, which is why when you ask people, who do they look for in a mate? What are the main traits? For women particularly, the number one trait is always sense of humor. That tends to win. For men, it's a little bit lower sometimes after looks and intelligence. And so I think the reason for sense of humor being so important is we recognize that someone with a sense of humor has a brain that can go through and work things out pretty fast, sometimes very fast. And that's a good thing to have in a mate, particularly if you're trying to guess who's, you know, worth keeping around for the long haul and help raise the children.
Well, is humor a sign of intelligence? Were Neanderthals not telling jokes, whereas Homo sapiens did? I mean, is it that anterior cingulate? Is it a more complex brain that can handle humor?
Yeah, you know, actually, it's a controversial topic. And I don't know if we'll ever know about primitive man if you know, he told jokes. But we can look at animals who are a good comparison. And these brain regions we share with apes and even rats and dogs. And we see all of these creatures laugh. We know rats laugh. We know apes laugh. Dogs laugh. Even penguins laugh. I spoke to one researcher. That's what he does for a living, is he tickles rats. And it sounds silly at first and maybe even trivial, but it's not, because he's trying to understand depression. And if he can understand what makes a rat laugh, you're on your way to understanding what makes people laugh too. Now, whether they have a sense of humor or not, it would be tricky. I mean, I'm not sure exactly what a rat would find funny, but there are stories of apes, and this is where it gets really controversial, but I'm a believer that apes have a different kind of sense of humor than us, but I think they do have. They enjoy a good joke. It's just theirs is very different because they don't have language.
Now, are certain types of humor universal among human cultures?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing, laughter is certainly universal. Everybody laughs, and it doesn't matter where you're from, or even if you've ever seen it before. And I think everybody has a sense of humor. And the funny thing is there's a particular kind of sense of humor that seems to be very common across the globe, and it's like this insult or kind of edgy humor where you're kind of making fun of other people. It doesn't have to be cruel. I mean, we very seldom pick on the lowest or the most at-risk members of our society when we joke about them. But we certainly make fun of lawyers and politicians and people, even sometimes from different ethnic groups just than us. And, I mean, some jokes are inappropriate, and some jokes are kind of telling. I guess one example I like to bring up is lawyer jokes, that we don't laugh at doctors, but we certainly laugh at lawyers.
Huh.
And I think part of the reason is we have mixed feelings about lawyers. I mean, doctors we kind of look at with only positive views, but lawyers have mixed views, and I think that's why we laugh at them.
Are there certain things, you mentioned a profession, but things that might be considered funny everywhere?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny. Jokes, if they succeed, they'll tend to succeed everywhere. So Richard Wiseman, he's a British psychologist, and he was interested to see what cultural differences there are in humor taste, and also if there are things like gender differences too. And so essentially he set up a website and asked people to submit their favorite jokes and also rate other people's jokes to see how they like them. And he got from that just over a million responses. He got tons of data to work with, which is great because that allows for some very specific analysis. So he found that British taste and humor were a little more absurd, American taste a little more aggressive. Scandinavians, ironically, tend to end their jokes with the words ha-ha at the end to, like, reassure the people, you know, oh, you've just
like
encountered
a joke. Like
a text message? Yeah, like just in case you didn't know, that was a joke. So maybe they're a little uneasy about their humor. But he did also find what I guess science says is the funniest joke in the world.
Let's hear it.
Okay. According to Richard Wiseman, a psychologist, this is the funniest joke in the world. Two hunters are off in the woods, and all of a sudden one of them just collapses, falls to the ground, and his eyes are glazed over and he's not breathing. So his partner, of course, is panicked. Like, oh my gosh, what do I do? So he called 911, and the operator picks up, yes, sir, what's your emergency? And the hunter says, oh my gosh, I think my friend is dead. What do I do? And the operator, very calm, says, okay, sir, calm down. First, I need you to check and make sure that he's dead. And so there's a pause on the other line, and then a bam! And the guy comes back. Okay, that's done. Now what? I'll say I'm a scientist, not a comedian. So part of it, you know, I'm not a professional person delivering it. Maybe if a pro is delivering it, maybe it's funnier. It usually gets a chuckle.
All right. We're going to get to that later, you not being a comedian. But let me first say that we're speaking with Scott Weems. He's a research scientist at the University of Maryland and author of a new book called Ha! The Science of When We Laugh and Why. Actually, how would you say it? Would you say, ha!
It does have an exclamation
how
point.
Do you
which
say,
I,
how do you yeah. read the title, Scott?
I let other people do it for me.
Oh,
I like how everybody does it differently. But I'll go with your ha!
Ha!
It needs to be loud and assertive. The exclamation point was my wife's idea, and I say that was genius.
Ha! The Science of When We Laugh and Why. It's a book title that makes you laugh in itself. Well, laughter is not always the result of a joke, though. There are some neurological explanations for laughing in inappropriate situations because of things going on in the brain. But maybe get to something that's a little more common to us. You know, laughing, my sisters and I used to call church laughter when we just couldn't stop laughing in church or at a funeral, you know, a really inappropriate time. What's going on?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is most of the time that we laugh. We often think of humor as just the process of telling jokes, but it's so much more than that. That's why I like looking at it as a psychological process. We joke at terrible times sometimes. Like I myself, one of the reasons I wanted to write the book is I laughed at my grandfather's funeral along with my cousins. And like, it's just terrible, you know, sometimes. And my wife broke out in laughter at the end of Titanic when Leonardo DiCaprio was drowning because she found the sentimentality just kind of overwhelming and funny. I think these are signs, first, that we're normal, so we shouldn't feel bad about that. And I think it's also why humor doesn't follow a formula or a rigid structure. It's really just a coping process. It's how we deal with our emotions, and it's a very adaptive thing. We should be very happy that we laugh so much at these things because the alternative would be to cry, and that's not as healthy.
Oh, I remember being at the very somber occasion of my friend Katie's mother's funeral, and Katie was up there in the front row, and the officiant came up, and I think he was one of these people, you know, you sort of rent for the occasion because she wasn't a particularly religious person, and said, There are times for laughter and there are times for mourning. This is one of those times. And I could just see Katie's shoulders start to sort of bounce up and down in the front row, and I just couldn't stop laughing. That's how it happens.
That happens a lot. I've had people through my website, because I've told stories like they share their own personal stories of laughing at funerals and whatnot, and some of them have had me falling on the floor laughing, just even though I wasn't there, but just I get it. There's times and that's just what we have to do.
Are there certain types of people who are funnier than others?
There are, but it's not who you would think, and it's not always. It doesn't always sound like good news, but a little bit of neuroticism is a good thing when it comes to humor. And this catches people by surprise and makes them worry because they think, oh, no, does that mean I'm neurotic? But it's not a pathology I'm talking about. It's a spectrum. And so we all lie somewhere between completely stable and completely neurotic. And studies have found, Paul Pearson, a British psychologist, he actually looked at cartoonists and found that the most successful ones were higher on the neurotic scale. So it's not always bad to be on edge. It's a good thing. We can use that. And humor is a great way to kind of get that out of our system in a healthy way.
Well, hypothetically, could you look at the brain of a person, examining their brain, could you tell if they're more prone to joke telling?
Yeah, you can. I mean, you can show people jokes. Some of the best jokes for doing this are the really absurd ones that are hard to make sense of, sort of like the old two ducks are floating in a pond, and one of them says quack, and the other says, I was going to say that. No, that's a very absurd kind of joke. And no matter how much you think about it, you're not going to really get it, right? Because it's just that weird. You give people a joke like that, and you monitor their brain. You know, you put them in an MRI scanner, and you look at how active their brains are. People who we call sensation seekers, these are people who basically very active in life. They seek out new situations, new experiences in life. Their brains are going to keep working to get the joke, more than someone who's a little bit more passive in their excitement threshold, I guess. And so it kind of shows that the more we look for intellectual engagement, the more we look to be pushed, the more our brains will respond to things like humor.
You've looked into research on a couple of different breakdowns on which type of people get jokes and even gender. Give us a little bit of the breakdown on gender.
Yeah, gender is a really tricky one here because, there are definitely differences in how men and women approach humor. Men outnumber women quite a bit in professional comedy. I think one study found maybe 12% of professional comedians are women. But that certainly doesn't mean that women have less of a sense of humor, because we also know that women laugh more than men. And there have been studies that have essentially gone out and eavesdropped on people in coffee shops and subways and seen that two women talking together will laugh twice as much as two men. If you look at the brains, and there have been people that have done this, looked at male and female brains while processing jokes, it turns out, and this is simplifying a little bit, but the results get kind of complicated, that women's brains are a little more active, even for jokes that are less funny, that kind of you have had a lot of that punch taken out. And so one way to interpret that data is women's brains work harder to try and get the humor, whereas men kind of come to humor with an expectation, and if they don't find it funny, they give up a little bit quicker. So, I think you definitely can't say that women have less of a sense of humor. It could be an environmental thing where women are just not pushed to go into comedy or to assert themselves in a comedic way as much as men are.
Well, it does take some courage and maybe some socialization to stand up in front of an audience and tell jokes. You gave it a try, Scott, when you're writing this book. What did you say about it, that your wife looked at you as if you were going to try out for the Red Sox just because you know their batting averages?
Yeah, it was that look that, you know, your dog gives you when you say you've lost your car keys, that just, you know, just what? What do you want to do? She was definitely skeptical.
So what'd you learn? And,
I learned that I'm not going to be a professional comedian. Mm-hmm. I didn't do terribly, but I came pretty close to terrible, I guess. I didn't do well. But part of it was, I knew I wouldn't. My goal wasn't to necessarily be a professional comedian, but what I wanted to learn was what does it feel like to be in front of an audience and try these things. And I learned that some things like rhythm, they just take practice, and just learning how to hold a microphone and tell jokes take practice. But at the same time, there were moments when it just felt great. These few moments when I got laughs and I connected with the audience, and I can see why comedians seek it out. And fortunately, I'm okay with not being a stand-up comedian. I had no interest in going into that because the research shows that just appreciating and surrounding yourself with humor is enough to get the benefits. So I'm just going to be happy with that.
Well, Scott Weems, we for one are glad you didn't quit your day job. I mean, wrote a great book. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
Scott Weems, author of Ha! The Science of When We Laugh and Why. You'll find more in his book at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, while psychics and the paranormal may often wind up as the butt of jokes, a recent Harris poll revealed that 29% of Americans have faith in astrological readings. Up next, NHBR's Sean Hurley samples what's on offer from New Hampshire's psychic community.
Word of mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. A 2013 Harris poll on belief shows that Americans believe a bit less in angels and a little more in ghosts than the last survey in 2005. Belief in heaven is down 6%, reincarnation up 3%. While faith in astrology remained level, belief in witches fell off 5%. NHBR's Sean Hurley isn't quite sure what he believes when it comes to mediums and witches and astrology. And to find out more, recently visited two psychic fairs in New Hampshire, a quiet gathering of mediums in Londonderry, and a larger fair with vendors at a Nashua hotel.
It's the end of the day, and the psychics are tired. Julianne, who organized the Londonderry Psychic Fair, introduces me to Rich, a shamanic medium and healer.
Can you do just bring someone in for him?
I'm really gone.
You can't, huh?
You look like you need a little rest.
See? Yeah. See, everybody sees it. They're all making fun of
everybody
me.
Everybody knows.
After 24 sessions, Rich is ready for bed. So Julianne offers to do a channeling for me herself. It's a little shocking when she begins. Her face and voice both alter. I close my eyes and listen.
Oh, it is so good to see you here with us, a gear in hand, beautiful son of ours.
Julianne channels for another 15 minutes, and when she's done, suggests that I keep her message to me private. It's for me alone, she says.
Can you tell me a little bit about your own sort of journey towards this?
So in my earlier days, younger days, I was did a lot of palm reading. My first job, almost losing it because instead of hiring people based on their application, I was reading their palms. But no, I know he'll go to work. I've seen it in his palm.
Julianne runs her own staffing agency now and continues to rely on the non-traditional resume of palms. But she also sees people in private consultation.
You know, 100 years ago, there were times we trusted our instincts. We trusted our judgments. We all had a sense of knowing, you know, so I work with people a lot to bring them back to that place.
I get in the car and head to the Radisson, a faux castle with a glossy interior and a wing of ballrooms. In the Nashua North Ballroom, it's Sierra's Sweet 16 party. In the Nashua Grand, the premier bride wedding expo is underway. And in the Balsam and Wentworth Ballrooms, it's the magical marketplace and psychic fair. 60 vendors fill the room, selling everything from spices to chainmail. I glide by the homemade soaps and mysterious runes until I find myself standing before my magical weakness.
I got magic wands. Not your Harry Potter type wands. These are real wands, harvested by myself while hiking in the woods.
Dante, the wand maker, has been harvesting wands for 20 years. In the Balsam, I sit down with Judy Seidel, who works primarily with cards. When she sees my eye drift to her druid animal cards, she spreads them out before me. I pick 3, and she turns them over. An eagle, a dog, and a snake.
The eagle is asking you to observe with new eyes. The dog is the guardian. The dog also is about being loyal to yourself, being true to yourself. The snake, you think of a snake shedding its skin, symbolic of rebirth and regeneration.
Across the room from Judy Seidel, Shah Blackburn, the loon witch, specializes in aura photography.
It's based on the principles of Curlian photography that all organic matter emits light and color. So you're going to have a seat in this chair.
Okay.
And then you're going to place your hands on these boxes. There's one on each side.
Now, is this the sort of photo you smile for, or you just...
You can, but we may not see it.
Okay.
Okay, you can take your hands off and relax. So that's you. I see you have this nice bright yellow, the lemon yellow here. And that tells me that you are a creative person, but you're not pursuing that creativity as much as you would like to.
My aura on the Polaroid photo also shows pain in my foot and neck, both of which are true. Both also could be said to be common human ailments. The question might be, is this magic or just universally applicable advice? And that can be as relevant as you like. For me, belief doesn't enter into it. I dream about eagles all the time. My ankle hurts. I have a creative project that I don't have time to work on. But regardless of magic, my attention has been refocused on each of these. I should take care of that ankle. I should get back to that project. So, when Julianne writes me an email later that night and expresses her hope that I found her channeling meaningful, I don't have any doubt or problem saying that it was. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
Up next, Word of Mouth shifts away from the metaphysical to the inner workings of the human brain. We're going to speak with a pair of neuroscientists who've put together a graphic novel set inside of the human brain. You can wrap your head around that right after the news.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Studying the various structures and functions of the brain is complicated stuff. We may be able to picture it all, but most of us would be hard-pressed to identify the lobes or the role of the hippocampus or the various parts of a neuron. Now, a pair of neuroscientists has created a visual, story-based guide that aims to make brain exploration exciting and understandable for a variety of ages. Dr. Matteo Farinella and Dr. Hannah Roche are authors of a beautifully illustrated new graphic novel called Neurocomic, and they join us together from England to tell us more about the project. Hello, Matteo. Hello to Hannah.
Hello.
Hello.
So going from the lab to the drawing table sounds like a pretty big leap. Wondering what possessed you to create a graphic novel about the brain, and what was your goal in this? Hannah, let's ask you first.
Well, when we were working in the lab together, we were both fascinated by neuroscience, and we felt that it would be a great opportunity to have a wider public audience be able to be interested in the neuroscience behind it. So we wanted to make it more accessible, and we just wanted to make it fun, really, because at the moment neuroscience can get quite heavy in the lab. And the way to do that was, we thought, to do a comic book.
So what was the division of labor here, Matteo?
Yes, I was the one drawing. So for me, actually, it was not a big leap. I spent many years dividing my life between science and comics. Mostly I was doing science during the day and comics at night. But in this project, I finally found a way to combine them. So for me, it was really great. I actually never hoped to do that.
Do you consider yourself an illustrator first or a neuroscientist second, or is that distinction even made?
I find it really hard to make it. I guess professionally I'm a scientist, because I always study science, and I was doing a PhD in neuroscience while writing the book. And I think I'm deeply inside, like, very scientific. That's what they tell me. But I also love to draw comics.
Very artistic as well. And there is a sense of adventure here. Now, one may think, okay, a comic about the brain, it must have anatomical diagrams. But it really is an educational adventure story. Hannah, is that the way that you see your research in the brain? An adventure?
It's an interesting way of putting it. I guess when you're doing research, it is all about discovery and about almost sort of having a narrative and a story even within the science, because that's what sort of drives you forward to answer questions about the brain. So in a way, even being a scientist in the lab day to day, it is about an adventure. Sometimes also I find that science can be quite constraining. So actually, an even further adventure, or like a leap from that, would be to do something more fictional, which is how we decided to go with Neurocomic, so that it was more of an adventure and more fictional than real science, because in real science you're obviously constrained by evidence and facts.
So for people who are listening to this, how would you sort of describe or give me a synopsis of this adventure that takes place in the comic?
Okay, well, it's really, as we are saying, it's an adventure, a sort of trip through the brain. Like, I was really thinking about the old classic education books, which are always kind of a trip. There is this unwilling character that finds himself in the brain, and he it's just looking for a way out. But along the way, to find a way out, it needs to learn about the brain and interact with the brain and the scientists who are studying it.
So he goes through this forest of neurons and meets these characters who tell him about their study on the brain. So we meet these very important kinds of brain scientists and go into these kind of rooms where things are happening. In fact, the hippocampus, or as you call it in the graphic novel, the archivist of the brain, is depicted as a seahorse typing away on a typewriter. And it's in this room surrounded by filing cabinets. And I'm wondering how you came up with these images. Do you draw on analogies and illustrations already common in scientific texts, Matteo?
Yes, actually, it's a very, well, not a metaphor, but that's where the name comes from. Probably like me being Italian kind of helps with the scientific names. Hippocampus is actually the seahorse, at least the Latin word for seahorse.
Why?
Because I guess it kind of looks like a seahorse. I mean, of
yeah,
course.
Yeah, the shape of it in the brain is like a curled
Well, you have to use some imagination, but that's the actual name. So I thought, yeah, I really recycle these metaphors, which that they are in scientific language, even maybe scientists are not aware of them, to actually like take them literally and turn them into characters.
Hannah, I've heard this phrase, the architecture of the brain. It's something we talk about a bit on this program. Now, you have in Neurocomic a typographical map of what you call Neuroland. Are you trying to introduce an element of fantasy into this exploration?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's always sort of to have like a map. I think both Matteo and I sort of obsessed with maps in general. I mean, I spend most of my PhD looking at connectivity between neurons and mapping them. And then it seems like a natural progression to have a Neuroland in the book where we can also sort of guide the reader through different parts of the brain, so to speak.
Hannah Roche, she and Dr. Matteo Farinella, are neuroscientists, together have put together a graphic novel called Neurocomic. It's like an adventure into the brain. Matteo, at the end of the book, the character wanders into some very deep territory regarding the meaning of the self and perception of our own identity. Now, these are not the sort of concepts that I think I've heard of in traditional texts about neuroscience and the brain, or are they?
The last chapters, I guess it ends in a more philosophical territory. We wanted really to sort of briefly cover the whole span of neuroscience, which is a very wide subject. So we started to from the basis, from like anatomy, what's the brain made of, what are the cells, what they look like, how they're connected. But then we also wanted to touch to the more abstract idea in neuroscience, which in the end, they all rely on these cells. That's the thing that really fascinates me about the brain, that all, even this most complex things like consciousness, in the end, they all have to come from these cells. That was the idea to show this connection.
Hannah, these are discussions that I'm guessing don't take place in the lab a lot.
Well, there's always the discussion of what is consciousness and can we understand it and can we find the sort of neural substrates of it. I think at the moment we're so far from achieving that I think it's important to still be able to talk about it in a sort of exciting way that we are still interested by it, but obviously that it remains one of sort of biggest frontiers that we still don't really understand.
I wonder if the creation of this graphic novel in a way was something that you wished you may have had when you were younger and first learning about the structures of the brain.
Definitely for me, yes. I grew up with this kind. I loved this sort of science illustrated textbook for children. I think that's what actually got me interested in science at first, because first I was interested in drawing, in art, and then I always loved this diagram, these complex diagrams and illustrations. So I couldn't really find anything similar for neuroscience, so I was trying to fill the gap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I feel like I'm quite a visual person. If I see something visually, then I can understand it, whereas if it's more sort of theoretical or conceptual, then I don't relate to it as much. So if I had had this when I was younger, I definitely would have really been grateful.
Well, Hannah Roche, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And Matteo Farinella, thank you also for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
Dr. Farinella and Dr. Roche are authors of Neurocomic. It's a new graphic novel about how the brain works. Now, you can see some images from the book and check out the fantastic book trailer. All of that is at wordofmouthradio.org. When the Whitney Museum of Art acquired Douglas Davis's digital artwork, The World's First Collaborative Sentence, back in 1995, there wasn't a conservation plan in place. After all, it's not like the work could fade or crack. But as the Whitney discovered, digital art decays in its own unique fashion. In 2011, the Whitney began the complicated process of restoring Davis's piece, which laid dormant since a server switch back in 2005. Milena Rysik is culture reporter for The New York Times. She joins us to talk about how conservationists restored a relic from the early days of the Internet. Milena, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Tell us about Douglas Davis's work, The World's First Collaborative Sentence.
Well, it's an artwork that he made in 1994. He was at the forefront of sort of technologically enhanced artwork. And at the time, it was really cutting edge. It allowed people to add a line or even a graphic image to a couple of sentences that he wrote that were written at the beginning. And it kind of functioned like a blog comment page does today. At the time, though, in 1994, this was really amazing technology.
Computer code doesn't decay like paintings and sculpture do, but it does become obsolete. So what's happened with this work?
Computer code actually decays very fast, to the surprise of a lot of artists and curators. So the Douglas Davis work just broke in a way that paintings and sculpture don't really, unless you smash them. I mean, it stopped functioning. You couldn't pull it up. It crashed your browser. You know, the text appeared as all this sort of garbled writing. It really didn't function at all.
So walk us through the restoration process and some of the questions that have come up in restoring this work.
The curators at the Whitney decided to put this work up about a year ago, and it took them a year to actually restore it because, first of all, when they went to look at it again, they realized it was broken. And second of all, they thought, well, we don't really know exactly how to fix this. I mean, our browsers and all of the things that we use to look at stuff on the internet have changed so much, even since 1995 when they got the work, that they had to get a special team of digital archivists, and it took them a year to do it. And as they were doing it, they started to unpack all these kind of philosophical questions about what makes a digital artwork tick in a way. You know, if you change the whole software underpinning of something like this, is it a different artwork? Does the way you present it visually, does that change its essential meaning as what the artist intended?
So what have they decided to do?
The Whitney did something that people in the art world don't really do, that's very, very rare. And they decided to duplicate the artwork, and they made two versions of it. One that they left frozen in the way that it was when people last looked at it, although they made it sort of legible. And then they made one that looks the same, but you can add on to it.
So this brings up to me, you know, why not just, instead of restoring the Rodin, carve another one, you know, a duplicate? What is the rationale behind this?
Right. Well, it's something that we haven't really dealt with before with those kind of artworks. I mean, you'd like to assume that only Rodin can make another Rodin. But an artwork like this, which is conceptual and based on code that is relatively easy to reproduce, you know, compared to like a Picasso, you can do that. So it brings up this whole host of questions of what makes this artwork unique, what is its value, especially now that the technology that was its underpinning is sort of very commonplace. You know, how does that affect the sort of context of this artwork? Museums and cultural conservators are all really worried about what they're going to do because the volume of stuff that is born online is increasing. And at the same time, they don't really necessarily have the teams in place, the expertise in place quite yet to deal with it.
Douglas Davis's work, The World's First Collaborative Sentence, as you mentioned, one of the first pieces of art using the internet as a medium. What does make it so special and one worth spending more than a year restoring?
Well, the curators at the Whitney feel that it was a real visionary artwork. And in a way, it prefigured a lot of the way that we use the web now. I mean, 200,000 comments appeared from people all over the world on this thing. And it really prefigured how we use the web today, you know, in making comments and making our voices heard and in bridging these gaps of geography and time and space. This is what we think of as normal now. But at the time, it was really forward thinking.
So have you added anything new to the sentence?
You know what I did? I did add on to the live version of the resurrected sentence. I wrote a line on there that said, "Will this exist in perpetuity?" Question mark. And you know, it doesn't have an answer, but it's out there. So I guess we'll find out.
Mylena Ryzik, staff reporter for the New York Times. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now you can find much more on digital art restoration, including Mylena's article, at wordofmouthradio.org. The weekend calls for a bit of sunshine, warmer temperatures, and some great movies. Word of Mouth continues with a sneak peek of what's playing at the Monadnock International Film Festival.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Here's an update on some cultural happenings. The second annual Monadnock International Film Festival kicks off tonight in Keene, New Hampshire. And here to tell us more about the program are a pair of filmmakers and the festival's executive director, Lena Barakat, and the program director, Aaron Wiederspahn. Hello to you both.
Hi, Virginia.
Hi, Virginia.
So what are a few of the films and events you are most excited about?
Well, I'm definitely very excited about tonight. Tonight, our opening night film is Before I Disappear. It was made as a short, and it won the Academy Award for Best Live Action Short. They expanded it to a feature-length film, and it just premiered at the South by Southwest Film Festival and won the Audience Award there. And we actually are fortunate enough to have the East Coast premiere of that happening tonight. And the lead actress, Fatima Patechek, will be with us. It's going to be a fantastic evening, so I'm very excited about that one for sure.
Elena, what do you want to add?
I'm super excited about the shorts program, actually. We have a really diverse slate. We have a few international films. We have all styles from animation to motion capture. We have some puppetry. We have dramatic kind of pieces that will make you cry, make you laugh. So I'm very, very excited. That's on Saturday morning, coming up at 11:30. So
right.
I'm pumped about that.
And that's at the Colonial Theater, I'm reading.
Correct.
Are most of these films at the Colonial Theater?
Yes. All of our main program is at the Colonial. Then we have two local look repeat screenings. Those are at the Putnam Theater. And then we have a few panels that are at Centennial Hall, which is in the Alumni Center at Keene State College.
And Putnam is also at
Keene State, correct.
I am particularly excited about a panel. I'm going to be moderating one on Saturday morning with some really interesting-looking women in film, and we'll be talking about women in film. Any others come up for you that you're excited about?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I would say Friday evening at 6 p.m., there's a documentary called Rich Hill, which just premiered at the Sundance Film Festival 2014, and it won the Grand Jury Prize for Best U.S. Documentary, and I think it's a phenomenal achievement.
Yeah, it looks like a kind of coming-of-age story. Have I got that right?
Absolutely, absolutely. It follows three teenage kids in this sort of impoverished, you know, down-and-out town of Rich Hill, Missouri. And it follows these three teenagers over the course of the year, and it bestows just such a beautiful dignity on these kids, like sort of climbing out of the depths to rise up and, you know, grab a piece of the American dream. And it's just beautiful, but it's a very honest look at the struggles of these folks, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful piece.
When you put together a program like this, who are you thinking of? Who do you think your audience is at these film festivals? Aspiring filmmakers, film buffs, a kind of mix?
Well, I think, you know, when I program, the curatorial, things that I take into account are really, you know, everyone. I want to bring in, filmmakers. I want to bring in just, you know, the everyman who wants to watch an enjoyable film. So there's a real diverse slate, you know, from pieces that are, you know, quirky, dark comedies to your art house fare to inspirational documentaries to, you know, shorts programs, because, you know, I'm a big believer that movies are the modern campfire. You know, they're where everybody gathers around listening to stories about who we've been, who we are, and who we can become. And so I want to really just be as diverse as possible, bring everybody to the table, and let's engage, watch movies, have good conversations with the filmmakers, et cetera.
Well, I know that red carpet can be a little challenging during the New Hampshire mud season.
Absolutely.
But I know you have a red carpet on the slate. Any notable stars or speakers going to be walking around in Keene over the next few days?
Yeah, we have a couple exciting things. As Aaron mentioned, the opening film tonight, Before I Disappear, we have the lead actress, Fatima Tejcek, with us. And she is actually, you might know her as the voice of Dora the Explorer.
She's 11 years old, right?
She is. I think she's 14 now. I believe she was 11 when she made the short and 14 now. But she is a precocious young girl with a lot of talent. So she'll be with us tonight. And then we also have screenwriter Claire Serra. She just wrote the screenplay for Blended, which is Adam Sandler and Drew Barrymore's latest film. The trailer's up on iTunes. I just saw it this morning. So she'll be with us.
We have an Academy Award nominated documentarian, Edith Belzberg, who's actually receiving our Jonathan Daniels Award this year. And that's our closing night film on Saturday, April 12th. And she's phenomenal. We have the lead actor for a film called Sarah Prefers to Run, which is a French-Canadian film that premiered at Cannes and at Toronto. And we have about 40 guests total in terms of directors, producers, actors, actresses, industry professionals, and a lot of wonderful people that are going to be here. We've filled up a lot of hotels in downtown Keene already. If people are coming out, they need to make their reservations quickly.
Lena Barakat and Aaron Wiederspahn, best of luck on what sounds like a really exciting festival. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Virginia. We look forward to seeing you there.
Yeah, thanks, Virginia.
I can't wait. Aaron Wiederspahn and Lena Barakat, they are both filmmakers, and they're both putting together the Monadnock International Film Festival, which kicks off today and wraps up this Saturday. Now, there are links to a lot more information, including the schedule, where to get tickets, and even accommodations. All of that is at wordofmouthradio.org. And now it's time to hear from you and your pets, as the case may be. Last week, we discovered that producer Taylor Quimby's dog sounds like a tent zipper. So we called on you to share your strange pet sounds with us. Here's just a sample. First, listener Coco's Beagle BB, a.k.a. Beagle Brendan, snoring. Tracy's miniature horse Benny kind of sounds like a typewriter. And Katie's cat says ack instead of meow. And we heard from some humans, too. Earlier this week, we spoke to a journalist who argued to abolish the Happy Birthday song, and we asked you to send us alternatives. We received this sweet message from Kathy.
My name is Kathy Arson O'Shea, and I'm calling in to sing the birthday song that I learned about 20 years ago. I don't know where it comes from, but it's a song people in the North Country up here in the Conway area sing. And it goes like this. We wish you a happy birthday, a joyous and celebrated birthday to our friend Virginia. May you have a happy, healthy life.
And finally, inspired by our segment on the cultural history of the elevator, David sent us this joke, which I will do my best to retell. An Amish boy and his father are in the mall for the first time ever, and they're amazed by all of these products and the scale and the spectacle, but especially by two shiny silver walls that can move apart and slide back together again. So they're staring at it, and the boy says, "What is this, father?" The father, never having seen an elevator in his life, responds, "Son, never seen anything like it." Just then, an old woman with a walker shuffles up to the moving walls and presses a button. The walls open, she enters the small room, the walls close, and the boy and his father watch as the small numbers above the walls light up sequentially. They continue to watch till it reached the last number, and then the numbers begin to light in reverse order. Finally, the walls open up again, and this gorgeous young woman steps out. The father, not taking his eyes off the woman, turns quietly to his boy and said, "Son, go get your mother." Can somebody get me a rim shot? Thank you, David, and everyone who shared thoughts and sounds and articles and even jokes with us this week. We do love hearing from you. If you've got something to share, chime in on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouth.
I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back with more Word of Mouth on Saturday at noon, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.